This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiao Yik. In the studio with me today, live in the studio, my first in-studio guest since the MCO started, Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon. We've been slowly having some of our guests coming into the studio. We started last week for the health show, but for me in the studio this week, Dr. Rajesh, you have the dubious honor. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Always a pleasure to be in the studio.
Yes, and today it's all about the ankle. For me, at least, the ankle is a joint that I give very little thought to until I injure it, if I do injure it. But there's a lot that it does, not least of which it supports all our lower body movements in our daily lives. Things like walking, running, climbing up and down the stairs, squatting, and so on. So Dr. Rajesh will be telling us why there is more to this hinge joint than meets the eye. And I also want to look at a study where scientists have found a way to reveal the mechanics of the subtalar joint in the ankle, which is also known as the human body's steering wheel. So if you have any questions for Dr. Rajesh, please do call us. Our lines are open, 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. To start with, Dr. Rajesh, what is the ankle?
Okay, look, the ankle's a joint, and I think the idea of what a joint is probably something that we should sort of clarify pretty early on. In a lot of the public view, a joint is like a hinge. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the challenge with saying that is that it's really an oversimplification where we lose a lot of ideas. So saying the joint is like a hinge is like saying that the eye is like a magnifying lens, or the ear is like, you know, a drum sort of membrane kind of thing. It's really a lot more complicated than that. So we should really look at sort of joints both from an anatomic basis as well as from a structural perspective. So if you look at it from a structural perspective, the ankle joint is unique in that it has a few functions to do, right? So when we talk about ankle, we talk about ankle and foot together. So the characteristics of a correct foot and ankle is that it is supple, strong, and stable. Mm-hmm. So these are three separate characteristics that need to be met. And the requirement for each characteristic is at times diametrically opposite to the other characteristic. Mm. So let's look at this idea of supple. So that means that the joints of the foot need to be able to move to adapt to an uneven terrain, right? So if you took a walking stick, for example, so if you had like a walking stick that you stuck into the ground, that's not really representative of how a foot works because there's no adaptation for the force that goes from the stick into the ground. Now, if you put a rubber sock at the end of that sort of stick, as it were, well, there's some adaptation because, you know, the rubber foot on the end of the stick gives you, you know, a little bit of grip, for example, so that the stick doesn't slip while you're walking and it spreads out the surface and contact area. Now, that idea of an adaptation of transfer of force is really what you have to consider when you're looking at the foot and ankle joint in particular, right? So sort of there's, you know, a bunch of joints in the foot, a bunch of joints in the ankle, and you put them together and you get the sort of foot ankle complex. Mm-hmm. And so when you think about the foot and ankle complex, what you have to think about is from a mechanical perspective, it's a complex series of levers and arches. And these complex of series and levers and arches has the joint, has the duty of, number one, absorbing force. So when you jump and you land, the force is going to be distributed somewhere. Mm-hmm. So in order for the force to be distributed in a way that it can be dissipated correctly, as well as stored for reuse and recoil, there's certain adaptations that way. And the arches of the foot is one of those adaptations. It has to be able to adapt to multi-axial movement at once. So if you take the analogy of a car, for example, the foot and ankle is like a four-wheel drive, because you should be able to go on fairly uneven surfaces while at the same time maintain traction and propulsion. Whereas if you drove a city car on, you know, muddy terrain, for example, the tires wouldn't be able to grip very much mm-hmm. because they don't have those sort of specialized adaptations to be able to function in different sort of environments. So I think the idea is if you look at the static function of the foot, it's to dissipate and absorb forces and to enable recoil of energy. If you look at the dynamic aspects of the foot, it's again to be able to adapt directional changes in force that we put in through the joint in a relatively efficient manner.
Yep. And all of this, you've been using the term foot. I mean, you've been using the phrase foot and ankle. Mm-hmm. We can't separate one from the other.
I think it's a little bit artificial to separate one from the other. I think, I mean, if you go to sort of like a mechanical kind of parlance, you would say that, you know, you've got the engine and then you've got something like a gearbox and then the gearbox drives the wheels, for example, right? Mm-hmm. So you could look at the foot and ankle complex as like sort of the gearbox kind of complex, the thing which takes the power, redirects it to the wheels, as it were. So it's a series of gears and each gear meshes with the other in order to transfer the force through. Mm-hmm. So I think it'd be a little bit artificial to look at the ankle by itself without considering the foot.
And you mentioned that it has to be supple, strong, and stable. Mm. And at the same time, from a language perspective, they seem to contradict each other.
They do. So let's take stability, right? So let's take just if you look at your foot now, you know, listening to this, you're in a car or somewhere where you can safely look at your foot. Just look at the top of your foot and then, you know, sort of move your foot up and down like you're pressing the gas pedal on a car or the brake on a car. So that's what we would call the tibio-talar joint. That's sort of what people commonly refer to as the ankle joint or having an ankle fracture. Okay. Now, if you were to turn your foot in and out, which is the perpendicular movement to it going up and down, that occurs at the subtalar joint, right? Now, if you put your heel on the ground, you would still be able to turn your toes off the ground, you know, lift your big toe off the ground and then lift your little toe off the ground. So that's called the forefoot. So you've got the forefoot, midfoot, and hindfoot, and that ties in with the ankle as well. So when you talk about stable, one of the very common things that happens is people tear one of the ligaments on the outer aspect of the ankle. Okay, mm-hmm. It's a very common injury to have. There are three ligaments which support the outer aspect of the ankle, or three parts of one ligament. And one of those parts tears very easily with an inversion injury. That means you're walking along, you miss a pothole, the foot twists in, mm-hmm. and you go, ouch. Then what a lot of patients come to me and say is, they say, look, you know, there was this time where I didn't have any issues with my ankle. And then I had this one injury where I was out with my friends, you know, literally like that. I tripped on the pavement and my ankle turned in. And the ankle's been unstable ever since. Mm. Okay. So that's sort of a very common scenario. And what's happened there is one of the stabilizing factors in the tibio-talar joint is gone. But not having realized it, the other stabilizing factors are not sort of treated to compensate for that. So just because a ligament is torn doesn't mean it needs to be treated. It needs to be diagnosed that it's torn. It needs to be diagnosed that it's structurally deficient. And then questions have to be considered to say, well, that one structure had a job. What other structures can do a similar job? And around the foot and ankle, lots of tendons pass through that area, mm-hmm. you know, sort of a huge bunch of tendons pass through that area from the leg going across into the foot. And those tendons have a function in stabilizing the ankle as well. And what I usually see is people at the point where those tendons are overloaded and can't do the job anymore. And that's when they come in with pain coming from tendon. But in actual fact, the root cause was the fact that the ligament was torn some years ago, mm-hmm. but they never properly recognized it.
But when one ligament it gets injured, and you say that there's the opportunity for the other structures mm-hmm. to strengthen and compensate, mm-hmm. What are the factors that would enable those structures to do that job on their own?
Okay, so the first thing is probably recognition, right? So there's this idea of patterning of movements. So people have characteristic patterns. You can sort of see someone walk down the corridor and at your workplace and immediately recognize who they were, although you haven't seen their face, mm-hmm. because you know the characteristic pattern of movement, the characteristic pattern of gait, the shape of their body, the way they hold themselves. So similarly, when you tear a structure within the ankle, it's not intuitive for the body to compensate for it. It's something that you need the deficiency identified, and then you need somebody to coach you through retraining the relevant muscles and tendons that cross the joint to compensate for that function. And that's something that can be done by any competent physiotherapist or any competent healthcare professional who has a musculoskeletal interest to be able to say, look, this is what the problem is. This is your deficiency. Let me demonstrate it to you. And then let me sort of prescribe you the exercises you need in order to overcome that deficiency.
And you started off by saying that that's something you hear very often. I had... one incident many years ago, and then now I have instability in my ankle. And we hear many stories where it's sort of a similar threat. Something happened many years ago, and then the pain either persists or it comes back. It's intermittent. Is there a way to put a finger on how long a timeline we'd see the ankle continuing to give problems when you don't pay attention to the initial injury?
Okay, so the answer to that is in two parts. I think the first part is to realize that there are adaptations and then there are maladaptations. And a lot of the time when I spend sort of some time with my physiotherapists looking at patients together, they are able to point out maladaptations that the patients have. I'm sort of a lot more interested in the anatomic structure, and I can say, look, you know, let's look at each individual structure and look at the specific tissue abnormality within that structure. And I do it with my ultrasound at the point of care. But what the physiotherapists have taught me is they've taught me that, well, the structure may be abnormal, but let's look at this sort of from a whole mechanical chain perspective, right? So what is an adaptation and what is a maladaptation? And those maladaptations I'm finding actually quite interesting, because people compensate by using different groups of muscles, which they wouldn't normally, or by adopting certain postures, which are detrimental to other areas of the body. And that then gives you this sort of maladaptive syndrome, which people need to unlearn before they can rehabilitate. So people would say, well, yes, you know, I've had this ligament issue for a while. I've done like three rounds of physiotherapy and I'm still not better. And these are with competent physiotherapists. And I think the reason is because the maladaptation hasn't been picked up. Right. And so that sort of bad habit hasn't been unlearned before the new habit is learned.
All right. And speaking of bad habits, I'd like to come back after this quick break to look at other things that we do, even shoes that we wear, that are causing problems to the ankle that we are not aware of. When we come back from the break, we'll get into that. Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon, is in the studio. Today's episode is all about the ankle. Do call us if you have any questions. 03-7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. We do have a question from Zaidi on WhatsApp, and we'll get back. Zaidi. Just hang in there. We'll be right back on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiao Ik. In the studio with me, Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon, and we're discussing the ankle today. If you have any questions, call us 03-7733-2900, or you can WhatsApp them to us 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. We do have a question here from Zaidi, and he's asking more about the foot, I suppose, but we are talking about the foot and ankle together. Zaidi says, I suffered from plantar fasciitis once, and he wants to know how to prevent a further recurrence.
Okay, so Zaidi, I think that's a good example of the static function of the foot, which is to be able to absorb energy and then to be able to release that energy in a way that the body can use again. So the plantar fascia is a structure right on the bottom of the foot on the heel surface, and it has a couple of jobs. One job is to store and release energy. The other job is to help with the maintenance of the arches of the foot. Now, one of the very common things which I see is the plantar fascia degenerates, and it's wrongly called plantar fasciitis. In medicine, when you give a term the suffix of itis, it means that there's inflammation. But there are some conditions in orthopedics actually where the principal problem is degeneration, but we didn't know it at the time that they were described. And plantar fasciitis is one of those. So it's probably more accurately described as a plantar fasciopathy. That means that the fascia is thickened and abnormal. Whether there's inflammation or not, you know, it's rarely, in my experience, it's rare that it's inflamed. It's usually that it's abnormally thickened. So to answer your question, Zaidi, if you have an abnormality in the plantar fascia, the question that I'd be asking is, what's the mechanical maladaptation that's overloading your fascia, right? So the first thing I'd look at is shoes. Are your shoes particularly rigid? So if you have shoes which are very, very rigid, sometimes people who work on, you know, oil platforms, certain industries, they have like very, very hard shoes. And because the shoes can't bend, the plantar fascia can't actually function correctly in terms of the absorption and release of energy. So one of the earlier misunderstandings, I think, was the fact that formal men's shoes, you know, the ones that go sort of clip-clop mm-hmm. on a hard floor, that those cause plantar fasciitis because the heel was very hard. But in actual fact, it's not the fact that the heel is hard, it's the fact that the entire sole is stiff. So when you walk, the plantar fascia can absorb energy, but when you lift off, it can't release that energy anymore.
Oh.
And so you get an overload of the plantar fascia, and then the plantar fascia starts to deteriorate.
Mm.
So then, you know, these sort of gel pads and things like that, which are sold as, in inverted commas, cushions for the heel, are not really addressing the biomechanical cause. They reduce the pain because you're not pressing on an abnormal structure, but they don't address the fundamental underlying biomechanical cause. So I think for you, Zadie, the question would be, what is it that made the problem? And having identified what it was that made the problem, it'd be, well, number one, avoidance of that. And number two, the exercise of the fascia. And exercise of the fascia is the same as Achilles tendon stretch. So if you Google Achilles tendon stretching exercises, basically the plantar fascia is a continuation, a homologue of the Achilles tendon. So the Achilles tendon is at the back of the heel, the plantar fascia is at the bottom of the foot. But if you want to say, well, what can I do to prevent a further recurrence? Walking on an incline, not so much, as you have suggested here, because walking on an incline supposes that you're stretching the plantar fascia without any other issue. But in actual fact, if you search through Achilles tendon stretching exercises, that's probably more relevant for you to keep your plantar fascia in good health. I can advise that being able to advise on how to prevent a recurrence, you would probably need to know what was the root cause in the first place.
Okay. Keep those questions coming in. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. Call us 03-773-2900 or tweet us at BFM Radio. And speaking of shoes, I want to ask, I'm sure you know what I'm going to ask about. I want to ask about high heels and similar, practices or habits. How much of that has an impact, on problems with our ankle?
Okay, so let me bring this case up. I saw a lady in her mid-70s. She was my neighbor from the days when I was in Alosta. Mm. So it's sort of quite funny to see her again, because she knew me when I was running around in short singlets and riding my BMX bicycle.
She hunted you down.
So she came in and her complaint was she doesn't feel stable. Okay, now, she likes wearing high heels and has worn high heels for very many years. And she says that she feels better with high heels, but everybody scolds her for wearing high heels now because she feels unstable when she walks. Okay. That, I think, is a very, very important case to talk about because it highlights a few things. Number one, it highlights the fact that the foot-ankle complex deteriorates with age and lots of people develop what I call a senile flat foot, which is that the static stabilizers of the foot have deteriorated because you've been standing on them for 70 years against gravity. And the dynamic stabilizers of the foot have weakened because you lose muscle mass with age.
Mm-hmm.
Then you get into this position where, remember I said the foot has to be strong, supple and stable. She's in a position where the foot's unstable.
Mm-hmm.
But when she wears high heels, she's stable, because that's the maladaptation that she's had.
Ah.
So because she wears she's worn high heels for so long, she's adapted to wearing high heels. And her children's insistence that she wears flats is actually making the stability of the foot even worse, because those muscles which would engage and stabilize the foot in flats haven't actually developed over a long period of time.
Mm.
So for her, when I said to her, yes, you can go back to wearing your high heels, the children weren't very happy with me. She was, but the children weren't.
But the doctor said so.
Exactly right. So the idea there being that I'm putting her back to a stable foot position for her, right? Mm. Because her foot's maladapted to having to use high heels. So when she rehabilitates she had a procedure done to her knee because she had a knee issue and a foot issue as well. So her knee was bent and painful, and basically the knee is now straight. So because the knee is straight, the question is, well, why aren't I stable? Well, she isn't stable because her feet are not stable anymore. And that reliably occurs with age. So I'm seeing a lot of patients now with what I'd call the senile flat foot, which is basically the structures which support the foot in a static manner have given way due to many years of standing, and the dynamic structures are starting to dysfunction in the way that every other dynamic structure dysfunctions. And these are the people who are at risk of falls, for example, right? They go, look, I'm a bit unsteady on my feet and I'm not exactly sure why. Mm. And, you know, while in the elderly, there are many reasons for being unsteady on one's feet, this particular reason is very easily identified, very easily corrected, and gives sort of a real big plus value in terms of improving people's quality of life.
Okay. But coming back to the question, but honestly, is there any point to me asking, as a general rule, are high heels bad for your ankles?
Yes, as a general rule, high heels are bad for your lower limb, right? You're not a giraffe. You're not a horse. Giraffes and horses have this equinus, which is where the sort of forefoot points down, and they have certain reliable mechanical problems that come about based on the way their foot is structured. And human beings who wear very high heels for a long period of time also have surprising those similar mechanical problems.
All right. And coming back to the senile flat foot that comes with age, are there other factors earlier in life, I suppose, that would predispose to that condition?
Okay, so let's talk about flat feet in children and work our way up from there. Now, everybody's nose is different. Why isn't everybody's foot different? The answer is it is. So you come from a family of people with sharp, high noses, then, you know, you have a sharp, high nose. You come from a family of people with relatively flat noses, you have a flat nose. Feet are exactly the same. So it irks me a little bit when I see sort of non-medically qualified persons at shoe outlets suggesting that there's only one correct type of foot and everything else needs special orthotics to adapt you to that correct type of foot. It's like somebody saying, you know, there's only one correct type of nose and, you know, you need a nose job, otherwise your nose is just not correct. So the idea is that feet come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. The usual argument starts with a shoe. So if your foot's not the general conform kind foot, then footwear is a little bit of a problem, and then you wear shoes, and then your shoes hurt your feet, and then you get problems from there. So I would say that except feet, they come in a great variety of flavors.
Not flavors, shall we?
So they come, feet are adapted to people in different ways for different purposes. And this has got sort of an evolutionary perspective. So if you look at people who, you know, from sort of a genetic perspective, came from flats and plains, their feet tend to be flatter. If you look at people who sort of descended from people who lived in mountainous regions, they tend to have rather higher arch feet, right? And this is sort of just an evolutionary remnant of what it was that they had.
Okay. Coming back to injuries, Kevin has messaged in to ask, he says, I have sprained my ankle several times in the last year, twisting inwards typically, with the first sprain being the most severe. I have a large bump on the medial side at the tip of the bone. The swelling and pain has gone down. I'm just a bit concerned why the bone could be swollen and there's no bruising.
Okay, so I think the answer to this question is perhaps best dealt with on general principle. The first principle is that when you see what you would think is a bone swelling, it's actually not a bone swelling. It's actually normal bone that was otherwise covered. So the analogy I always give is if you look out at the ocean and you see two big rocks in the ocean where you hadn't seen them earlier in the day, it's not that the rocks came up, it's that the tide went down. And I think that's the first thing that Kevin has to realize. The fact that what he's seeing as bone swelling is probably the loss of some adaptive function or position of the foot, which is now causing him to get the impression that the bone is swollen without any bruising. The fact that the ankle keeps giving way is exactly what I've said, as we discussed at the start. It's probably a lateral ligament tear. Lateral ligament tear hasn't been diagnosed and treated correctly. And now there's a maladaptation of the position of the foot at rest that gives you this impression that you're looking at a bone swelling.
Ah, I see. So what should Kevin do in this case?
Okay, so Kevin should seek proper appropriate care for someone to be able to diagnose the fact that he's torn the ligament, if indeed it is a ligament tear, whether there are any problems with it, and be able to identify what sort of exercises he would need in order to be able to restore that function.
Mm. You know, I'm just curious, of say 10 patients who have ankle issues, mm-hmm. how many of them always start with, you know, well, I twisted my ankle at some point and...
Hardly ever. Oh. Hardly ever. Usually you have to ask. So the lady who comes to mind is a cook of a rather senior statesman whom I'm looking after now. Mm-hmm. And she says that she can remember clearly having fallen down on a slippery floor and the foot folding in under her.
Mm.
Okay. But that was 20 years ago. And it's been fine since then. So people may recount an injury to a part which may or may not be related. You know, somebody asked me about my back pain. You know, I say, yeah, you know, I fell off my motorcycle a bunch of times, but, you know, I was a lot younger then. Related, not related, don't know.
Mm, all right. We have another question that we'll get to after the break. Do keep sending them in. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899. You can also call us 03-7733-2900 or tweet us at BFM Radio. If you want to talk to Dr. Rajesh, you really can call us. He hasn't been in the studio for a number of months. Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon, talking to us about the ankle today. We'll go for a quick break and we'll be right back on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiao Ik. In the studio with me, Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon. We're discussing the ankle today. If you have any questions, the lines are open 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Here's a question about footwear again, Dr. Rajesh. Sylvest is asking, does wearing padded shoes inhibit intrinsic foot strength? So she says she's been wearing barefoot shoes for decades and finds wearing a so-called normal shoes difficult as she does not have the tactile feedback from the ground and she feels super unstable.
Okay, so let's get to adaptation. So in your use of five fingers and barefoot shoes, you have adapted to a particular way for your foot to respond to the ground. Now, seeing as how we don't live in a competitive survival environment anymore, that's probably not going to make a big difference for you, you know, in the long run in terms of how your feet function. Assuming that you were loading your feet normally and subjecting them to normal stresses, so, you know, sort of not doing something strange like climbing, rock climbing, barefoot or something like that, then you're unlikely to have done your feet any harm. The reason why you feel super unstable when you're wearing normal shoes is because you're used to a high degree of tactile feedback and you've trained in a certain pair of shoes, as it were, and now you're wearing a different pair of shoes. So, of course, it feels different. You know, so I think that's probably the explanation for that experience. So I don't think wearing padded shoes inhibits intrinsic foot strength. I think it inhibits intrinsic foot proprioception.
Mm.
So you've seen those sort of things on YouTube and the internet where somebody is born without hands and uses their feet for day-to-day activities like brushing their teeth, painting, writing, all of those things. That's actually the capability of the intrinsic muscles of the foot. It's just that because we don't need it, we don't train it up to that point.
Mm.
Okay, so if you wanted to do more with your feet, you know, you definitely can train them to it. But to say that wearing padded shoes inhibits intrinsic foot strength, I think it inhibits intrinsic foot capability, not just strength.
So then to turn the question around, is there anything wrong if she were to just continue wearing the barefoot shoes?
No, not at all.
Mm, as long as, like you said, she's not loading it abnormally.
Right? So, I mean, her nose, my nose, your nose, different noses.
Mm. So we've been talking a lot about instability of the ankle, but on the flip side, what about tension or tightness?
Okay, so look, tension or tightness is, I'm thinking about this lady I saw in the clinic today. She had a problem with the Achilles tendon. That's a large tendon at the back of the leg that inserts onto the heel. And her complaint was of this sensation of tightness, which she just couldn't get away from. It just felt tight and achy all the time. Well, it feels tight and achy because usually of a tendon abnormality. So for her, the question wasn't, what is the problem? That was sort of pretty obvious at the start. The question is, what factors are involved in your problem? And for her, she works in a Chinese restaurant and she does both the serving and the till. So before MCO, she was busy, like, you know, standing 15 hours a day because she was managing the coffee shop herself. Since MCO, it's a little bit better. And then as the MCOs relax, her problems come back. And then so she's come to me.
Mm.
So for her, the challenge is, what do we do to be able to offload the tendon to allow it to heal while at the same time allowing her to do work? So I basically put her in a heel race. I put her in basically a situation where her Achilles tendon was relaxed because she's in like a high heel kind of situation, accepting the fact that when the tendon heals, it'll be short. But, you know, she says, that's my charimakan. You know, I can't have the option of 6 weeks away from work because, you know, the shop feeds everybody. So for her, the idea was, how do we offload the tendon to allow it to heal so she doesn't have the sense of discomfort? The answer is just to shorten the tendon. Mm-hmm. So that takes that sense of tightness away. The other very interesting case I had was a lady who'd had a stroke recently. And when people have strokes, we talk about two things. One is spasticity, the other one is contracture. Mm. So spasticity means that the thing is like a very sensitive rubber band. So when you touch it, it sort of recoils or springs. Contracture means that the rubber band becomes short. Now, most of the time when you talk about contracture, you're talking about the contracture or shortening of the whole muscle tendon unit. But with her, she had this, her complaint to me was, she has this unbearable tightness that never goes away, and nothing she does can take the tightness away. And she's seen everybody and everybody said, well, your problem isn't a contracture, so you shouldn't have tightness. But in her, the problem was not in the whole muscle, but in the parts of the muscle. So she was developing contractures in the parts of the muscle. That means the parts of the muscle were getting, or the parts of the sort of muscle tendon unit were getting shorter and tighter. But the gross picture wasn't clinically apparent yet, and you could only pick it up on a dynamic ultrasound while moving through her problem.
Mm-hmm.
So that was quite instructive, because treating that scar, she said her symptoms went away.
Mm.
Right? So this idea of tightness having to be on like sort of a gross or global scale, I think that idea is being taken apart for me. The idea is that any part of the muscle tendon unit can actually, shortening of any part of the muscle tendon unit can give you this sense of tightness, even though you don't have a clinically apparent tightness.
Mm. And what would have led to only the specific parts of the muscles?
Because she has a brain injury, those specific parts of the muscles are overworking all the time. And because they're overworking all the time, they get injured. And when they get injured, they get scarred.
All right.
And then when they get scarred, they get more irritable. And then that goes round and round.
Okay, all right. We do have a question. We do have a caller on the line. Hi, Surya, you have a question.
Yes, I have a question for the doctor.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Surya.
Okay, my question is, this is regarding my son, doctor. Mm-hmm. He was squealing. He was in the cadet, so he does kawat every time, eh? Mm-hmm. So my son now today, when he walks with his heels first, you know. And so my son, all his shoes, so the heels get worn out faster.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked him, why you do it? He said, after doing the kawat, he's like already used to it, already on to. So how does he change his style of walking back to the normal walker?
Okay,
will it hurt his heels in the later part of his age? He's about 30 now.
Okay, let's ask some basic questions first. How old is your son now?
30.
30.
Yes.
Okay, and how long has he had this issue with the shoes now?
Oh, this thing, during his secondary, form 4, form 5, that time.
Form 4, form 5 already started.
That time. So now he's having about 10 years.
Yeah, 10, 15 years. Yeah, okay. Okay, thank you for the call, Surya. So I think this is a very good question to demonstrate this idea of there are lots of different ways in which we can use our skeleton. So your son's obviously learned to walk in a particular way, and that walking in a particular way is probably biomechanically not so efficient. And that's probably part of the reason why he's sort of wearing his shoes out. The challenge in these sorts of situations, Surya, is retraining the skeletal system takes a lot of time. So your first question is there likely to be long-term damage? Answer is, I don't know enough about the situation to be able to assess it. You know, I'd have to see him to look at the structures which are already there, whether they're damaged in any way or not. But the challenge with these things is trying to break a bad habit. So let's say that, you know, for argument's sake, you never smoked. Then, you know, if you tried a cigarette, you went, ugh, that's disgusting, and then you never smoked again, that's fine. But if you're already in the habit of smoking, then that's very, very hard to stop. So the challenge with him is he has learned patterns of walking, which were obviously ingrained during the time he did this Kawat stuff. And those have sort of been with him for the past 10 or 15 years. So for this, you really want to see somebody with an interest in biomechanics. And your son has to be interested in solving the habit himself, because it'll take time and effort on his part to be able to listen to what the physical therapist or physiotherapist says, to listen about what muscles and movements need to be strengthened, and for him to really want to change. Because if he feels that there isn't a problem, then, and we can't demonstrate or find a problem, then I would say, well, there's no problem, you can leave it alone. That's right. Just the way he walks. Mm-hmm. But if we can demonstrate a problem that's going to come, for example, and we give advice and say, well, look, you know, on the basis of walking like this, you're likely to injure, you know, this, that, or the other joint, then that's something that he may want to take into advice as to whether he wants to change that or not.
But also the fact that he pointed out it stemmed from something his son did regularly when he was a teenager. Mm-hmm. And I think that speaks to the concern that many parents have from how much of a habit formed in childhood mm-hmm. will impact or will cause problems later on. And how will we know it's problematic back then? You know?
Yeah, so look, you know, I'm a parent, I have kids, you know, I look at the same thing as well. Certain things I can say clearly are harmful, right? So, you know, when my kids slouch in the shape of a prawn in front of the computer with their head sort of hanging off the edge, I can clearly say, well, that's going to cause a problem later on. So certain things which we can clearly identify, then, you know, it's pretty easy to correct. But other things we're not so sure yet. So I'm not so sure about the sort of the thumbs used for mobile phones. You know, my kids' thumbs fly over the mobile phone in an uncannily fast fashion.
Yes.
We'll have to wait and see, you know, in a generation from now when, you know, they're adults and they have their issues, then we can have a look at it and say, well, you know, this is the effect of, you know, keyboards are one. When we design keyboards, mm-hmm. we never envisage that they would cause so much trouble. Mm-hmm. They didn't happen in typewriters. And the reason why it didn't happen in typewriters is because with typewriters, you had long strokes of movement, you know, in order to be able to make the clickety-clack, clickety-clack. Mm-hmm. So you actually were gliding tendons through their full range while creating that particular type. Mm-hmm. The problem with the modern keyboards we have is that you have small repetitive movements, and tendons and joints aren't designed for small repetitive movements. You know, I keep saying the skeletal system is designed for Tai Chi, not Kung Fu.
But interesting about keyboards, I mean, I feel like they're designing them to be even softer touch, so to speak, or even touch screens,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so I think softer touch is okay, but the distance you travel to create the touch.
Ah, right. Okay. So at the beginning of the show, I briefly mentioned a study about the subtalar joint. So in this study, the scientists have found a way to reveal the mechanics of this joint. I found that interesting simply because it claims that, you know, you've never been able to see how it works before in motion.
Two words. Clickbait.
It was in a journal and everything.
Clickbait.
Okay. But you did mention the subtalar joint earlier, and it controls the inwards, outwards movement of the foot.
Yeah.
All right. Is there anything significant that we can learn from what the scientists have been able to see?
No. Okay. Right. So the thrust of the paper is basically saying that using imaging technology, we can now, based on imaging technology, right? So just get that right. We can, on the basis of imaging technology, predict the axis of movement of the subtalar joint.
Mm-hmm.
So if something moves in a hinge, it's pretty easy to predict its axis of movement, which is just up and down. If something moves in three planes at once, it's a little bit difficult to predict its axis of movement. So all they're saying is, you know, the axis of movement was there when I was a medical student, right? And that was in the early 90s. So, you know, you can't expect me to believe that this is a new discovery that hasn't been there from the early 90s. But what we had in the early 90s was we basically had a textbook with a picture on one side and a picture on the other side. And then they said, when you hold the two pictures together, then you can imagine how these two surfaces fit together, right? So a little bit crude, but basically it allowed us to imagine what the function of the joint was. And from an orthopedic perspective, we know what the center of axis of rotation of the subtalar joint is. It's basically a line that joins the two malleolus, sort of the bone on the outside part of the ankle and the bone on the inside part of the ankle. It's got, you know, a rotation of about 12 to 15 degrees, and it's got like a sort of up-down movement of a few degrees as well. So from an orthopedic perspective, we've been able to describe it for a while. What these guys have done is they have basically looked at it from an imaging perspective and said that with these imaging technologies, you can predict what the center of axis of rotation is.
Mm.
The relevance for that, the direction that they're taking for that, is to plan joint replacements.
Mm-hmm.
So when you design a joint replacement, the joint replacement is a mechanical thing, but it has to mimic a biological function.
Mm-hmm.
So in designing joint replacements for knees, for example, originally we considered them just a simple mechanical hinge. Now we've gone beyond that and we're considering them to be sort of a sloppy hinge where there's a degree of bend, but there's also a degree of slide and glide. And we've found that those designs function better. People have higher degrees of movement. They can move better with those. So I think the direction that this paper's going in is basically trying to get to the end point to say that by imaging, we can predict what the function of a joint is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, fine. That I will give them. But to say that they've discovered, in inverted commas, is just clickbait.
All right. Very quickly, a question from Harry. Does wearing oversized sneakers cause corns or calluses on the underside of the left foot behind the little toe, whereas there's no corn on the right foot?
Mm.
Or is the cause due to imbalanced walking, meaning placing more weight on the left foot?
Okay, so Harry, I think you've answered your own question. It's basically imbalanced weight on the left foot because both shoes are the same. Mm-hmm. The difference is how you use the feet. You would probably be a senile flat foot because that's what I see. I'm not suggesting you're senile, but I am suggesting that you have a flat foot due to age.
All right. What does he mean by oversized sneakers?
Okay, so Doogie Howser, MD, do you remember that TV program?
Yes,
or was that before yours?
No, I'm actually old enough to remember that.
Okay, so so it's basically just that, like, you know, sneakers, when you look at them, you go, oh my God, those are huge.
Right, of course.
I think that's basically
okay.
It.
Okay, all right. Final message about the ankle.
Foot and ankle. Yes. Yep, so I think I don't think you should separate the foot and ankle. That's probably the first message. The second message is that the ankle has certain things that happen to it as a result of injury, and those things are gradually progressive. So if you've had a foot and ankle injury and you've just been leaving it alone saying it'll go away, it probably won't. It'll probably come back and bug you later in life. And there's lots of very useful, simple exercises that you can do to correct stuff without any major surgery. So the message for foot and ankle is, I guess, a stitch in time will save you 9.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rajesh. I've been speaking to consultant orthopedic surgeon Dr. Rajesh Singh all about the foot and the ankle. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.